session number 13152, Real One.
Wing Commander Paris, Real One. Could you tell me where you were born, please?
I was born at Haddenham in Buckinghamshire.
And which year was this?
On the 28th of June, 1920.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a solicitor, like his father and my great-grandfather as well, who were all solicitors.
Did you go to school at Haddenham?
No, I went to school at Tame, which is about 3 miles away, to Lord Williams Grammar School there, one of the old grammar schools.
How old were you when you left there?
16, and I became an office boy in the Bucks County Council, in the clerk of the council's office, in fact.
How did you come to be in the RAF?
Well, I had two older brothers, and the second one of those had taken a short service commission in 1936, which was the year I'd left school anyway. And I didn't think I was really cut out to be a local government official of any sort at all. On the other hand, my brother Tim was having a marvellous time in the RAF, with flying and games and so on, entertainments. And so I decided that as soon as I was old enough, I would apply for a short service commission myself. It seemed a very, very attractive life, which I did when I was 17 and a half, which was the earliest age at which you were allowed to apply. And I had an interview in early 1938, January or February, something like that, and eventually I got a letter saying that I was accepted, and I then was instructed to report to number one elementary reserve and flying training reserve, elementary and reserve flying training school at Hatfield, which was of course run by de Havillands at those days. And there I went. The day before my 18th birthday, I did my first flight in a Tiger Moth, starting my training.
Did you have any difficulty in learning how to fly?
No, I was pretty average. I think the usual thing was to go solo on Tiger Moths after about between eight and ten hours. 10 hours was getting rather a lot. 8 to 8.5 hours was very common, and I went out in 8.5 hours.
Did you think the short service commission system was a good one?
Oh, marvellous. Marvellous. It gave a lot of opportunities to people who to have commissions straight away who wouldn't, of course, have been selected probably for Cranwell.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I'd finished my training and I was towing drogues on an ancient biplane called a Fairy Gordon. And it was the target tower for an armaments practice camp up in Yorkshire at Catfoss, near Hornsey.
What was your reaction to the news that we were at war with the Germans?
Well, that came through. This is a very clear memory for that day. At 11 o'clock, we were all in the anteroom in the mess with the commanding officer, the station commanding officer, whose name will come to me later. And we were listening to Chamberlain's speech saying that a state of war now was now in action with Germany. The next thing was that somebody went off, the duty officer, I think, went off to look up to see what our war postings were, because people used to move around, was scheduled to move around in the event of war breaking out. And he came back and he said, and spoke to the station commander, who made a short speech and said, "You are now going to fly to Aldergrove in Northern Ireland," which meant we were fleeing west from the enemy. By this time, in fact, we'd been re-equipped with Hawker Henley towing aircraft, and the Gordons had gone. But we spent the next couple of hours swinging the compasses to make sure we were going to get there, and off we went. We actually stopped the night at Stranraer, and then went across to Watergrove the following day.
But were you dismayed at the news of the outbreak of war?
Well, we knew it was coming. The day before the war broke out, the 2nd of September, I was the duty officer, in fact, orderly officer. And one of his duties was to decode any secret messages which came in. And sure enough, we got two. One was the standard five-figure code, which we did. And with the education officer had got into uniform, and he was brand new. He knew nothing at all about codes or anything else. And so I said, OK, I'll come across to do it with you in the CEO's office where the secret codes were kept. And as I say, one was the standard five-figure code, which we got out, and I can't remember what that said. But there was then another one in a completely new code, which I didn't even know about. So we then started ransacking the CEO's safe. Eventually found a small, very slim green book, and it was just one set of five or six letters or something like that, and we had to look this up in this little green book, which said, relations with a certain foreign power are becoming extremely strained, or very strained. This is on the Saturday night before the war broke out. Anyway, that's how the war started as far as I was concerned. Concern, yes, partly because I wasn't in an operational squadron at that stage, and of course everybody wanted to be in on the act, so to speak, partly because, of course, at that age, there's bound to be a certain amount of excitement, but also a certain amount of apprehension, I think, as well, as to how one will react in action, whether you could take it or not.
So you quite definitely wanted to be in an operation.
Oh yes, very much so. Anyway, 3 weeks later, I was back on the East Coast again, towing drogues again. In biplanes, back to biplanes. I'd been on monoplanes, now I was back to biplanes again.
Can you tell me how in the winter of 39-40 you flew your first Hurricane?
Yes. I was posted to St. Athan, which was number 11 group fighter pool. It was the forerunner of the OTUs, really. But there wasn't the same amount of training as they got in the OTUs. It was really just a conversion course onto the Hurricane. The cockpit of the Hawker Henley was exactly the same as the Hurricane. It was, in fact, a two-seater Hurricane. So I had no problem at all flying a Hurricane. I'd done about 50 hours on the Henleys, and so I was very happy to go on the Hurricane. As a result of that, I was obviously also the most experienced pilot at the end of the course, and there was one posting to France, and it came my way.
How did you feel about that?
Oh, that was tremendous stuff. Everybody was envious of me, because I was going to be in action, within a few days, probably. In fact, I wasn't, but it didn't happen that way.
How did you actually transfer to France?
I went down to Southampton. I stayed the night in the big hotel in the middle of the town. Was it the Dolphin or the Anchor or something like that? I can't remember now. The Dolphin, I think. And then the following evening, embarked on the ferry. I've forgotten which one it was. And we hung around a bit. Anyway, we set off at dusk, or when it was pretty dark. It was raining like hell anyway. And off to Cherbourg.
And this was which month?
That was 24th of January.
Can you tell me about the place you went to in France and what kind of facilities it offered?
Well, first of all, we had to spend that night on the ship. We can edit this out if you don't want it. I spent the night on the ship, and then I reported to the transport officer on the station, and he gave me tickets to go to a little place called Vitry-en-Artois, which was via Arras. It wasn't far from Arras. And it was a miserable journey. There was a hell of a lot of snow on the ground. You know, really was terribly, terribly cold. A window in the windows in the carriages were broken already. I don't think they'd been bombed. It was just broken down transport. A bit like BR today, perhaps. And it seemed to take an awful long time because it was dark by the time I got to Vitry. And there were a couple of paraffin lamps on the platform. And in my fractured French, I asked for where the squadron was. And the fellow pointed to the station hotel, which was just outside the station. And we were using that as a mess. We were all billeted out elsewhere. And my first billet was in a barn. I was up in the loft with animals down underneath. So it was fairly a fair old pong around. And I had my camp kit, the canvas bed and canvas bucket and canvas wash basin. And my I was allotted a batman who had been a tailor in civil life. Remember, this was an auxiliary squadron. A lot of these chaps were the equivalent of Territorial Army. And my batman happened to have been a tailor in Newcastle. And he led me round to this billet, in fact, with a torch. And we climbed up the ladder in the loft, and there I was. And it was bloody cold, I'm saying. Anyway, he turned up in the morning with a cup of tea, which was still hot. How he did it, I don't know, but it was there. And I got out of bed, and I washed and shaved in cold water, and then had to report to the CO, who was rather short. I think he was busy about something else. I don't know what it was. Anyway, it was after 2 or 3 days, or I'd been in this wretched barn, which I thought I was going to get pneumonia. He asked me what my billet was like, and so I told him. And the fur flew then, because I should never have been there. And I was given a new billet over a little estaminet near the church. The fellow who owned it was the local church sexton, Dick Gravedigger, and his wife ran the estaminet.
What about the personnel in the squadron? How experienced were
they? Oh, before I go any farther, I should have said this earlier. I was a bit surprised when I arrived at Vitry. My first sight of the aircraft, they were gladiators. I was back to biplanes again. however, the fellows in the squadron were absolutely marvellous. I was a bit apprehensive because I knew that all the pilots were, you know, were wealthy people. You had to be wealthy to be an auxiliary pilot, officer. But they were absolutely marvellous and did me untold kindnesses of sort of support and settling me in. And they knew that I was living on my pay. There were two other regular officers in the squadron. One was John Humperson. He'd been the flying instructor and adjutant before the war, and also, of course, ran the cadre of regular airmen in the squadron. And he was a very nice chap indeed. And the other one was a fellow named Chatty Bowen. Chatty because he couldn't stop talking. And he was a short service commissioned chap like me. He'd been in it rather longer. He was a flying officer. Didn't actually call him sir, but you treated him with respect. but the rest of the fellows, they were absolutely marvellous. I'll never forget them. Switch off for a minute. Okay. Well, the fellows in the squadron were absolutely marvellous. Did we have that?
Yes, sorry. You said that, but you were just about to tell me about Kyle.
Oh, yes. Well, my first flight commander was Joe Kyle, who achieved some fame when he was shot down in Germany by threatening the soldiers who'd come to arrest him with was a revolver. Sense prevailed in the end, and he was unfortunately made prisoner of war. That was much later on. My next flight commander was Francis Blackadder, and he's still alive, although not at all well. He was a Scottish rugby international in the 1938-39 season. And he again was delightful. He was generous. For some reason, we went down, four of us or five of us went down to Rouen, flew down to Rouen. And we went into the town and went to that famous restaurant, the Coq d'Or, which is, you know, one of the three Michelin stars and a sky-high bill at the end of it. And so when we'd had lunch there, which was absolutely, you know, lasted about 3 hours, and came the time for the bill, and I said, well, what's my share? Wondering if I'd got enough with me. And I was shushed and said, no, it's all paid for. And these chaps had obviously paid for my lunch. This was the kind of generosity you got from them. Anyway, we flew the Gladiators quite a bit. That photograph of the poster, which featured in the poster, was taken when we were visited by a number of war correspondents and an RAF photographer who had pilot officer's uniform on. And I was, we were the three of us going out to give them a little beat up over the airfield. The CO was leading. I've forgotten who was number two. I was flying number three on the port side in the Gladiators. We still had Gladiators then. And I was walking out to my aircraft, and I had my kit on and my parachute sort of over my shoulder, half done up. And the photographer stopped me and said, would I look back at the top of the Nissen hut, which I'd just left? And he got down on one knee and took a snapshot of me. And that snapshot was the poster.
This is, we should say, this is the famous RAF recruiting poster.
Yes, yeah. And I just went on and climbed in my airplane. We did a little beat-up for them.
What did you think of flying the Gladiator?
Oh, it's a lovely aeroplane to fly. When I was training, I'd flown the Hawker Fury, which was the other single-seater fighter biplane, the last of the two seaters, the last of the two single-seater biplane fighters. And they were both beautiful aircraft to fly. They were so manoeuvrable and forgiving, because you've got biplanes that are fairly forgiving usually. And the Gladiator was a lovely one. I only once thought, I didn't think we were going to get into action, but we made an attempt at it. It was obviously a forlorn hope. There was a very high-flying German aircraft. Must have been about 10,000 or 11,000 feet, I suppose. We were on the ground in our Gladiators. It had gone over the airfield, going northeast. Obviously a reconnaissance aircraft, and I think we were just taking off for some reason, and so we'd spotted it, and we tried to chase after it, but the Gladiator didn't have a chance against something like a Ju-88, or which it probably was going fast.
Did you see anything of the French Air Force?
Not a lot, no. But then that's not surprising, because we were up in the north of France and we were supposed to be supporting the British Expeditionary Force. There were two fighter squadrons down on the Maginot Line front near Metz and Reims, around there. And that's where the French Air Force were. They left the northern sector to us to defend, I think.
So you were really part of the air component of
That's
the
right.
British Expeditionary Force?
Yeah. Yes, we were part of the air component, yes. Yeah. We were not in the advanced striking force.
Any other incidents that happened before the German attack?
With the gladiators? Well, then we were started to re-equip with Hurricanes. And I was the only, I was the youngest and most junior pilot in the squadron, and I was the only one who'd flown a Hurricane. So they sent, we got a Master, Miles Master training aircraft, to introduce the rest of the squadron to low-wing monoplanes with a retractable undercarriage and flaps. And I was taken down, and we had a Magister as well, that's right, yes. And I was taken down on the Magister to Rouen. And I can never remember whether it was Rouen-Beauce or Rouen-Glissy. There are two airfields there. But it was the depot anyway, obviously. And I flew the first Hurricane for the squadron back to Vitry. And that was on the 8th of April, which is just over 4 weeks before the invasion. So, by the and of course, in those 4 weeks, we were very busy training on those aircraft. But even so, in 4 weeks, you can't convert a complete squadron into an efficient fighting service unit. However, came May the 10th, and I was on dawn readiness. I think the day before we'd had to produce a section of three at dawn, or half an hour before dawn. And I was in the mess with, I think it was Francis Blackadder, and I can't remember who the third person was. We were having a cup of tea at about 3:30, because dawn was 4:15, so we had to be up there at 4:15. And we were having a cup of tea, waiting for the transport to come and pick us up to the airfield, which was about a mile away, 3/4 of a mile or a mile away, I suppose. And we heard the truck pull up outside. It was a three-tonner, which was the usual transport. But instead of waiting there with the engine running, the driver ran into the mess, which is an unheard of liberty by an airman to run into the officer's mess. But he was quite right, because he said, "There are German aeroplanes flying overhead, sirs." we started to hear the engines then, and so we hurled ourselves into the truck and went up to the airfield. And I don't think I stopped running. I sort of ran into the crew room and got my kit on, still running out into my aeroplane. And discipline went to the winds. I had my engine started first, and I think the troops had started the engine anyway. I was in and off by myself instead of waiting for my leader, which I wasn't ticked off for it, actually. And there was a stream of Heinkel 111s flying over the airfield. And this is the impetuosity of youth. I saw two in front of me as I took off. They were going northeast, and I was taking off northeast. They were going home, so I went after them. They were about 5,000-6,000 feet, chasing them. But I had to climb, and so it was going to be a long, slow stern chase. And I eventually realized that we were getting very close to the German border, just as I was getting into range. It was still long range. The Belgian border. And, of course, we'd always been briefed very strongly not to fly over Belgium, because if we were had to land, we'd be interned for the rest of the war. And one chap from the Advanced Air Striking Force was, in fact, in a castle in Belgium, interned. Mickey Martin, I think it was. And so I loosed off all my ammunition at rather long range. I was rewarded with a return of a bit of tracer from the rear gunner of the rearmost of these two Heinkels. So I'd been fired at in my first combat, as well as firing at the enemy. Whether I did any damage or not, I don't know. I threw out 2,250 rounds of ammunition at him, so something might have hit him, I don't know. Anyway, and I came back, and of course on my way back, there was the rest of the stream of the Heinkel 111s coming up behind. I was a fool. If I'd just done a 180 after takeoff, I could have had my pick of any of them. However, that was the first combat, and then really things, the memories get a bit chaotic, I'm afraid, because looking at my logbook, I see that I did five sorties that day, And I haven't got the first one I remember. I haven't got any memory of the other four, and yet I shot down two Heinkel 111s during the day, and I got absolutely no memory of it. It's quite extraordinary. And the following day, we'd had a very good day on the 10th, I must say. On the following day, the 11th, the three of us came across a Heinkel. I think Willie Gore was leading. The other chap was a fellow named Trevor Jay, who was killed in the Battle of Britain later on. He was flying number three, and we latched onto this thing, went in one after the other, line of stern, one after the other, and gave it a pounding, and then broke away and came back to come in again the second time. Well, the second time we came in, the thing was smoking like mad and a few flames, and it was going, the nose was dropping, it was going down. But we still went at it, and the rear gunner was still firing at that stage. Trevor Jay was the third, was the number three, and he was the last one to go in. And having done his second attack, instead of breaking away, he went up and formated alongside this Heinkel. The rear gunner was still firing, and he got Trevor got a bullet through his knee for his pains. He managed to get his aircraft back to the airfield and landed successfully. But he was obviously wounded. He was, I think he was Casamacked, actually, back to England. But strange thing to do, and I never heard of anybody else doing anything like it. And then after that, there were patrols. There was one day we were bounced by the squadron. I was flying in the usual four Vicks of three in line astern, and I think I was number three on the last section on the port side. And the first thing I knew was a couple of almighty bangs on the armour plate behind me, and we'd been jumped by 109s. It was the first time we'd seen fighters, in fact. And I'm not sure what date that was. It might have been the 12th, or I think it was probably the 12th or 13th. So I peeled off very smartly, and I didn't know what damage there was to the aircraft. And I kept my evasive action going downhill, I'm afraid, in a spiral. I pulled out and did a complete circle to looking up to try and find the squadron or what was going on, the fight or whatever, and the sky was absolutely clear. It's quite extraordinary. I'd lost the whole lot somewhere. So I came home, and the engine was running okay, but there must have been some damage, I reckon, and I was a bit worried about it. But when I landed, only two rounds had hit the aircraft. They'd both hit, obviously both, one had hit the radio, and the other one had broken a former in the fuselage. It sounded as if the thing was, you know, really was going to be falling to pieces any moment with the noise that they'd made coming in. Very strange. Oh, 2 days prior to that, on the morning of the 12th, the day before, on the morning of the 12th, I'd been on dawn readiness again. No, the morning of the 11th it was. I was on dawn readiness on the 11th, that's right. And I got a signal from the Air Ministry saying that my elder brother had been was missing. He was a Whitley pilot.